Heading to CBC? Make sure to stop by booth 1989 to chat with the Brewbound team, check out our live podcast recordings, and find out about Brewbound's upcoming events. Have news to submit ahead of the show? Head to brewbound.com/submitnews to let us know about your latest updates.
Welcome to Season 2 of the Brewbound Podcast. Today is Thursday, October 17th, and I am Justin Kendall, editor of Brewbound. I'm joined today by BevNet editor-in-chief Jeff Kleinman. We're going to start Season 2 with a talk with Douglas Constantiner. We'll be on the air with this season over the next couple of months, then return with Season 3 in early 2020. But before we get started, I want to say something. We left the air for a while over the summer. We don't want to run away from it. We also don't want to go back over it, except to say that we are trying to learn every day the best way to win your respect and trust. And we hope to hear from you about the kinds of discussions and content that best reflect the evolving industry and culture that comprises craft beer in 2019 and beyond. So for the rest of Season 2, we've got some compelling interviews with people ranging from Sierra Nevada founder Ken Grossman, Odell co-founder Wynn Odell, Brewers Association president and CEO Bob Pease, and quite a few other surprises. But this is as much your podcast as it is ours. That's one thing we realized this summer. So as we go forward, we're interested in hearing from you about what is working, what isn't working, and how we move this thing forward.
Thank you, Justin. I'm really honored to be here with you, and I've got an incredible amount of confidence in the way that this podcast is going to roll out. And I'm really eager to hear this first interview with the co-founder and CEO of Society Brewing. You know, I've actually enjoyed Society's beer a couple of times, but I never realized that it was a brewery that's really facing so many transitional points.
That's right, man. Society started producing beer in 2012. It had a draft-only focus. But in this past year alone, the company has went through a number of changes. There was the departure of co-founder Travis Smith, the end of self-distribution as Society signed with San Diego upstart wholesaler Scout Distribution, and the start of packaged beer for Society. Well, going to be the start of packaged beer here very soon, so everybody can take the Pupil IPA home with them.
Are they going to start selling their stout?
I think they're going to sell it all if they can.
So I need it.
I had the chance to talk with Doug during the California Craft Brewers Association's annual beer summit this past September in Long Beach. We discussed Doug's journey into craft beer. He had a very, very surprising gateway beer that you'll likely never guess. And we're going to talk a lot about the evolution of the business, how you go through a brewery divorce, and preparing for all of this growth that's going to come as they begin to package their beer and get it out through distribution.
Well, I'm eager to hear it.
Well, let's get to it. Here's Douglas Constantiner. This is Justin Kendall with Brewbound, and I'm here at the California Craft Brewers Association's annual summit. And I'm joined by Society Brewing founder Douglas Constantiner. Got it?
Got it. That's
Got it. Doug, how does someone go from being a summer intern at Bear Stearns to being a brewery owner?
So, all right, I'll try and make a long story short, but at 18, I knew I wanted to own a brewery one day. I feel lucky I found my passion that young. I got into beer younger than I should have, younger than the law would like. I think there's probably a statute of limitations on that, but I fell in love with craft beer at like 16, 17. I was like, this is awesome. And it was Rogue Chocolate Stout that did it.
Really?
Rogue Chocolate Stout, because I love chocolate. And I was like, wait a minute. Yeah, I've been drinking like macro beer. I don't want to say what it was. But, you know, I was like, you know, we were just drinking beer to drink beer.
So that wasn't a gateway beer, though.
Not the macro stuff. The Rogue Chocolate Stout was.
Yeah. And the Rogue Chocolate Stout was your gateway
that
beer.
That was like I flung my head back and I saw a higher being. And I was like, wait a minute. Beer can taste like chocolate. This is absolutely crazy. And then I immediately started reading about it, whatever I could do. My mom also knew about it because she got like really pissed at one time. she found a bunch of empty beer cans.
And rogue she's like, cans?
No, like macro cans. Mm-hmm. And she's like, if you're going to get into this, honey, you need to do it the right way. I don't want you binge drinking. Like, I'll get you beer, but you have to drink it like 1 ounce at a time. And it's like once a week. And so she would like bring home beer and I could taste it every once in a while. And it just destroyed books. I just read everything I could about beer, whatever was available out there. And when I went to college, I knew I wanted a brewery. And I was like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. I went to a prep school, and I don't want to say it was my parents because they said you could do whatever you want, whatever makes you happy. But I guess like my upbringing, all I knew was like one day I have to be a lawyer, a banker, or a doctor. And that's what you do. And if you're a doctor, you start your own little practice. If you're a lawyer, you start your own firm. If you're a banker, maybe you start your own fund, or, you know, you get into hedge funds, private equity. That was the like the extent of the entrepreneurial spirit. And I liked all that stuff. I thought it was really cool. But I was like, all right, well, if I start a brewery, what do I need to do? So I went to college. I'm like, I'm going to major in finance. I'm going to go to Wall Street, work there for a couple years. And when I'm 45, I'm going to retire. And I'm going to have $30 million in the bank. And I'm going to start a brewery. And a couple things happened when I was in New York. So I had a couple internships at Bear Stearns. And then I worked at a small boutique investment bank firm called Burnham Hill Partners. And it was there that I started to kind of get impatient, and a couple things happened at the same time. And I said that every day I'm not doing this, there's somebody out there younger than me that's doing this. And Six Point, way back in the day when they were tiny, 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 I drove up to Captain Lawrence for some bottle release. This is now 12 years ago. I was hanging out in the car with these guys driving up there, and they said, hey, why don't you have, like, if you're really into beer, because I was a huge homebrewer. I was just really, you know, I wanted to brew beer, so I was just making beer at home. They're like, why don't you come intern one day a week for us? And I said I couldn't because I don't have any time off. I'm working 7 days a week.
Jeez.
It was like 14 to 16 hours a day, and usually like 8 to 10 hours Saturday and Sunday. And I told myself at that point, I never want to let that happen again. And at the same time, you know, it's hard to really remember the timeline of everything, but I was out at dinner with my mentor, and, you know, we were talking about what's next, because I was about to apply to business schools, and he was going to write me a recommendation. He's like, so what do you want to do? Like, are you going to come back here? Do you want to get into private equity? What's the whole goal of going to business school? And I said, well, I laid out the story of, like, I'm going to retire at 45 and this, and he goes, look, Doug, I'm 37. I'm very happily married. I have three beautiful kids. He goes, you think my wife's going to let me quit and move to California to start a brewery? It's like, you need to do this now. So that combined with my fear that every day I'm not in professional brewing, somebody is, and they're getting better than me. I made the decision, I got to do this now. I got to jump off the cliff. I got to do this now. And so I built a little business plan, and over 6 months, kind of gave them my notice and said, I'm moving to San Diego. And it's between San Diego and Portland. And I really love production brewing. And at the time, 12 years ago, it was Portland was known for brew pubs. San Diego was known for production brewing. And I saw it as a place that has the highest concentration of world-class breweries. You had Ballast Point, Ale Smith, Pizza Port.
Well, that's ballsy of you.
Yeah, Stone. When you have blind ambition, you don't think about, like, is this a big risk? You just do it.
Yeah.
And I just did it. I was young and blind. And I was like, oh, well, let's just do this. So I moved to San Diego, worked at a couple breweries. And after I started it way too soon, I thought I was going to probably work for breweries at least for 10 years. But I kind of saw that beer was becoming cool. You know, when I left investment banking, people were like, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to become a brewer. They're like, what do you mean? Like microbrew? I'm like, yeah, it's called craft beer.
They probably thought you were nuts.
Yeah, they thought I was nuts. All of a sudden, you see this like sharp spike and this ramp up, and then everyone's like, oh, dude, craft beer is cool.
So you're right in on the wave.
That's the idea, is we need to get in before this door shuts. And by we, so I started the brewery with a business partner, Travis Smith. He's no longer my business partner, but we were brewing together at the brewery, and he had left the brewery. The brewery in Orange County. He had left for another brewing job, and we would meet up all the time and have beers. And one night we're sitting there and we're like, let's do this. Cause if we don't do it now, it's going to be too late. And I had like what I would call my life mentor. I saw him at the brewery And I didn't know he was going to be there. And he's like, yeah, I'm just going to like sleep around the corner at this hotel. I was like, no, just come back to my house and, you know, we'll have some beers. And we had some beers. He's like, you do this now. I was like, I'm not ready, Lloyd. Like, I'm not ready. And he's like, it's just like having a kid. You'll never be ready. Go talk to Travis and y'all get this done. And when I talked to Travis, Travis was like, yeah, I was going to say the same thing to you. We got to do this now. So that was 2010. And we kind of saw how popular everything was getting and that craft beer was cool. And in San Diego, we picked San Diego. Neither of us are from there. We picked it because you had the Stones, the Alesmiths, the Ballast Points, the Green Flashes that already primed the market. Like, if you're a San Diegan, you were drinking IPA 15 years ago, and you just thought it was normal. It wasn't like, I'm a craft beer drinker. It is, yeah, it's just an IPA. What? I like it. And it doesn't matter who you are, your age, your income, you just drank IPAs, and we really like IPAs. So we're like, let's do it in San Diego. I said it was going to be a short story. That was a long story. I'm sorry.
Oh, it works.
Malt Europe Malting Company is North American proud with premium grains from field to flavor. Our selections include base, specialty, and distillers malt varieties. Stop by our booth, 2143, at the Craft Brewers Conference in Vegas. Does your brewing software suck? We've heard it from thousands of brewers. Connect with Ollie today and we'll buy out your current contract and hook you up with brewing software that doesn't suck. Visit booth 1685 at CBC or hit getollie.com/pod.
Give us a little bit about the mission statement of Society and what you guys do.
So the mission statement of Society is really why I fell in love with beer, and I think everybody loves beer, and maybe they don't realize it, is that Society is for everyone, and beer is for everyone, and that's why it's called Society. So with beer, it's unlike wine. It's unlike whiskey. It's unlike fine food that I don't care if you're a plumber or you're a plastic surgeon. If you get those hooks into you and you love beer, you're going to connect with people who also love beer. And you go to a home brewers guild meeting and you see guys who are making seven figures and you see guys who are making $30,000 a year and they're all buddies. And it's like, this is crazy. It's like the ultimate uniter. I mean, it's certainly beer in general is a great social lubricant, but it is the ultimate uniter for everybody. And that's why we called it Societies, because beer's for everyone. No one is too good for beer and beer's not too good for anybody.
And you were self-distributed up until, I think it was, what, June 1st. June 1st, okay.
Yeah, so we started out in San Diego. At the time, there were 50 breweries, which seemed like a lot then, but now it really isn't that many because we're at, like, 165 or 170. There were only two distributors. There was a big Miller Coors House, and then there was Stone, and both do a great job. I mean, they're awesome. But there was a lot of space to do your own self-distribution and really own the market and get our hands on the kegs, get our people in front of the buyers. So we decided let's self-distribute and really control our product in this crazy competitive market.
How difficult was that to start up not only a brewery, but also self-distribution?
It was difficult, but it's less difficult than starting up and signing with a distributor immediately. Mm-hmm. Because if we were to have opened and signed with a distributor right away, we have no brand equity. There is no drive, and you're on a truck with a bunch of other brands. So self-distribution, I think, is very important for every small brewery. And I'm talking small, you know, a couple thousand barrels a year at the most, because if you want to scale, when you sign with a distributor, a wholesaler, your partner, you're going to need that scalability. The scalability is harder than actually the work behind it and the logistics behind it.
Well, I was going to say, though, you are adding the added complexity of logistics that you didn't have before and trying to figure all that out on top of, you know, just the brewing.
Right. In the beginning, again, when there were 50 breweries and 2,000 breweries in the United States, we spent half as much then as we do now or before we signed on sales of the beer. So it took us twice as much money, twice as much effort and energy to sell the same amount of beer. So instead of having a salesperson that did our sales and deliveries, we now had a logistics person, a sales manager, sales reps, and delivery drivers. And that was the only way to operate. So what ended up happening was it took a lot of our mental energy and focus off of our core business, which is brewing beer. We are a brewery. We are not a logistics wholesaler distribution company. And it came to a point where we said, if we really want to succeed, we should focus on our core business and then learn how to work with a distributor. Mm-hmm. And that was the main thing. And I think, again, at a small level, it's brutally important to do this yourself because you learn so much about how a distributor works and how difficult it is for them.
So you would definitely recommend people self in the state of California?
Yeah, wherever you can self-distribute, I think it's a good idea to at least give it a shot. Worst case, you know, you sign with a wholesaler and something goes wrong, you know how to do it and you can do it again.
Well, you're in a very fortunate state, though, where right. California doesn't have franchise laws locking people in. So right. you're able to a little more freely move than others would be.
That is true. And that's why, you know, we chose the state for a reason and we chose San Diego for a reason. And, you know, it wasn't on accident that we started there. And it's a really good, it's one of those things where it's like, you got to go to the gym, you know, even though you don't want to. Self-distribute for a little bit, see what it's like, feel the pain. Because, you know, one thing I've experienced before I started the brewery was I would see these, you know, how much we were selling kegs for and bottles for at other breweries I worked at. I'm like, man, y'all are making so much money. And where's this? Why am I getting paid nothing? And then when you start self-distributing, you start to realize, like, wait, these distributors aren't just like, you know, printing cash. Like, this is a tough, tough business. And they are very smart and very competitive. You get a lot of respect for how hard that business is. That is a tough business. I mean, they are, we were talking about the other day, they're finding pennies, yeah. you know, and that's how they have to survive. And we're lucky to have distributors. I think that's when you get to a certain level, thank God for distributors.
At what point were you guys like, it's time to make the change?
In today's day, it was 4,000 barrels a year, yeah. only in San Diego. I think 7 or 8 years ago, when there were 2,000 breweries, it probably would have been 15,000 barrels. It's just gotten tougher. You know, like I was saying, when we opened, there were 2 wholesalers, 50 breweries. Now there's 6 wholesalers, 165 breweries, and another 150 breweries, national big breweries, who are trying to sell beer in San Diego. So our sales guys went from being able to walk into a bar and say, do you need another keg of Pupil, to waiting 45 minutes to talk to the beer buyer.
Wow.
So you got to shift. And I think that's a very important thing in business in general, is not being tied to what your business plan is and saying, I got to do what's best. It's call the play. You get to the line of scrimmage and you see something's different, call an audible.
Mm-hmm. So you decided to go with an upstart wholesaler, Scout Distributing, which was started by Jeff Hansen and Josh Landon, who everyone probably knows from St. Archer. What was it about going with an upstart as opposed to a more established wholesaler that attracted you to them?
So long story short is I know they wanted to use us and I wanted to use them, you know, oh. and but no, the real long story is I've known Josh.
That was the best answer, though.
Yeah. It was great because, you know, everybody advisory board and all this stuff is, you know, they're a startup. They're going to use you. You have 600 handles. And I'm like, good. I want to be used. I want to be used. This is perfect. It's like a perfect. And that's where we are now. It's like, this is fucking perfect. Like, we're going to be used because we're using them, too. And mm-hmm. I feel bad because I'd always told Steve Wagner and Greg Cook that they have the best distributor in San Diego, if not the country. They probably are the best craft brewery wholesaler in the whole entire country. And I'd always told them that it's unfortunate y'all are only in San Diego because this is our only market. And if we sign with a distributor, we're going with you guys. But then things changed and there were multiple distributors. And the reason why we went with those guys, so I've known Josh since St. Archer started, even before it started. I think he had connected with me and we'd gone out to have a beer and talk business and stuff like that. I'd known Jeff even before that. Long story short, Jeff was my sister-in-law's best friend's boss, if you follow me on that. So I've known him.
I've got a flow chart now.
Yeah. So I've known these guys for a while, and I know there's a lot of, sometimes criticism of St. Archer, but look at what they're doing. Look at what they've done. They're successful guys. And not only that, what they've done with Scout is they have a lot of people that have left other distributors and other breweries, and they built an incredible team. Mm-hmm. They built an, and I told Josh, and we're meeting one time and we're getting close to signing. I was like, Josh, you're awesome. You're the man, but I'm not signing because of you. I'm signing because of the team you built. we really went with Scout because they're changing everything. Like, they're changing the way wholesalers work, and the old school wholesalers who do, they do such a great job, but they're like, what is this new model? And that's why I was kind of like, oh, if y'all are questioning it, maybe there's something to this. And you combine like my desire and drive for change and shaking stuff up with an incredible team with great leaders and great employees, it seemed like a match made in heaven. And they have incredible brands with them, and they would have done well without us. But I think it's one of those things, I hate to use the word synergy because it's such like a corporate business word, but it very much is a 1+1=3 with Society and Scout. And man, I mean, we're great friends, and that's what you want in a partner. And you really are getting into a partnership. I mean, this is more serious than marriage, even in California. I can't imagine another state. So you better have a good relationship with the people and not just think about it as like a strategic, tactical, contractual thing. These are your friends. These are your partners. And it was a tough decision, though. I mean, there's so many good distributors in San Diego, and we have great ties with everybody. And it was probably the hardest decision I've made to date.
So you make that decision. What advice would you give to brewers who are sort of in the same position where they've either been self-distributing or they just haven't gone to market in that way yet? What advice would you give to them when they're selecting a wholesaler partner?
So my advice would be, and this is basically if you're going to go down the road of selecting a wholesaler, is they're not going to do the sales for you. They will help. They are an accessory and a peripheral sales team, but it's on you to sell the beer. And it's on them to get it there. And that's what they're good at. And that's their job. Now is the time to double down on sales and marketing. And when picking which one, it's who you guys get along with the best. There's also footprint. Like, a lot of the guys in San Diego also cover Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really good benefit. So there's a distributor that also has 12 other distributors across the country. So if we wanted to go to Chicago, we wouldn't have to do anything differently. We would just give them the beer and they'd put it in Chicago. And it depends on where you want to be. So instead of saying where I want to be in 1 year, look at where you want to be in 20 years. And then back yourself into where can we be in 10 years and where can we be in 5 years and 3 years and then 1 year, and make a decision based off of that. And know your numbers too, because distributors generally take 28% to 32% margin on it. And they have to operate their businesses off of that. Again, I'm very protective of wholesalers, and man, they work hard and they run a good business.
So where do you want to be in 5, 10, 20 years?
What's our best option for success? Where is our strength? And if we go to Denver, I have to compete with New Belgium and all the other great breweries in Denver. If I go to Boston, I've got to compete with Sam Adams and Harpoon and all the great breweries there. If I go to Long Beach, I have to compete with Beechwood and Stone and Ballast Point and Green Flash. And if I go to San Diego, I have very few competitors that can knock me out. So I think our greatest chance of success is competing in San Diego, because I know we can win in San Diego. It doesn't mean we have to be the most sold beer in San Diego, but can we crack top five? Can we be up there with Stone, Ballast Point, Alesmith, Modern Times? Sure, I think we can. But I can't say we can be top five in Denver or Portland or Austin or Boston or New York or Chicago. So our goal is, let's sell as much beer as we can in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see where we can take this. It's our most loyal fans, our best beer drinkers. I mean, we're at 800 tap handles and we haven't even started packaging yet. People love us in San Diego. I don't know if they love us in Toledo.
Well, they might not know about you yet.
Yeah.
They just don't know they love you.
And that could be next. You know, if we max out San Diego, then I
Toledo.
Think
it, Toledo.
Then Toledo
is the next.
You guys are next. If y'all love Society and you're willing to take, you know, 100,000 CEs a year, then go for it. But I think it's a regional move after that if we are able to get to that level.
So we talked a little bit about how you're draft only largely, and that's going to change. Why make that change? What was the big decision there?
So I'll start with why we're draft only. And I firmly believe that the best way to ensure quality and success, which is based off of quality, outside of business practice, being draft only as a small brewery ensures you the best success, because when you start kind of dabbling into the less expensive, less highly quality engineered canning and bottling lines, I think there are a lot of problems that can happen. And if you don't have a lab, you shouldn't be packaging. That's just what it comes down to. You should not be packaging if you don't have a lab and a QA, QC program and a sensory program. As you grow, though, there comes a certain threshold where maybe a bottle or a can is safer than a keg, because once that bottle or can leaves your brewery, you know exactly what's going to happen to it in the next 90 days.
Yeah.
And with the keg, there's a lot of variability in it. It could be tapped in wrong and the wrong tap. There could be dirty glassware. All these different things, there's all these variables at the retailer that realistically don't happen that often. But with a bottle or a can, like, I always look at Sierra Nevada Pale as, like, I know what I'm going to get in that bottle, and they know what they're going to deliver in that bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure every brewery's experienced this, but there's been times where I get text messages and someone's like, dude, your beer tastes weird at XYZ place in San Diego. I run over there, and usually it's either easily
you start
fixable.
Cleaning lines?
No, well, so we did all of our own line clean. So usually it's like easily fixable. It was like a simple mistake, or it was a bad glass, or the wrong keg was tapped in there, or yeah, it could have been a dirty line. But you know, that kind of stuff happens. And so with canning, that's where we want to go next. And we've always kind of restrained growth, and we've never grown just to make money, but we want to grow when we are scared of pissing off the consumer. And we've seen it with a couple breweries where they stay so small, and then the retailer, the consumer finally says, you know, F you, I'm never going to carry your beer. And I want to stay ahead of that curve. But I also want to, San Diegans want the pupil in a can so they can take it home.
Mm-hmm.
And for the listeners out there, Pupils are flagship IPA. It's award-winning and has been named best IPA in San Diego multiple times. I mean, we're doing a disservice to our own citizens to make a draft. You can't drink Pupil at home.
In your society.
Unless you come to the brewery and get a crowler or a growler of it. And so it's kind of silly how long we've made this like protest against packaging. So we'll get a canning line, and hopefully at the earliest will be February, and at the latest May, we'll have a lot of our beers and cans available all over San Diego. And look, our customers keep us in business. That's mm-hmm. what it comes down to. They're the ones who keep the lights on. Let's give them what they want. And they want the Pupil. It's not like they want a beer that we don't make and we need to kind of create a beer to get them happy. They already like it. They love it. They're crazy about it. And let's empower them.
What do you think that's going to do for business?
I think it'll triple it overnight.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah, we have a grand master plan. We'll go from 5 to 15,000 barrels in no time.
Wow.
Well, it'll probably be 50-50 cans packages. And the second we start getting in cans, you get the customer awareness. And that customer awareness is going to make you buy the beer on site. And
so what do you do in advance of that to sort of prepare for that big of a leap to regional status?
It's a lot of planning, financial planning. Oh my God, it's financial planning. I probably spend, out of the 70 hours a week I work on society, I would probably say 50 of those are preparing for this. It's knowing my costs. It is being realistic about my projections and knowing what goes wrong. And can we sustain something that goes wrong? There's a great book called The Road Less Stupid by this guy, Keith Cunningham. It's incredible. He said, what separates the pro athletes and the big decision makers from somebody who doesn't make it is they know the consequence of a bad shot and they can accept it. And Tommy was saying it the other day, Tommy Arthur was, he said, I don't plan for 4% growth. I plan for negative 20. And that is so true. It's, do you know what can go wrong with your decision?
Yeah.
And it's not being pessimistic. It's being realistic. And that's what I preach is look in the mirror, look at yourself personally, where you are in 20 years and where's your business? And how much runway do you have? And we're pretty small, relatively to San Diego. I mean, we're bigger than the median, but smaller than the mean, the average. And I think we have runway. I'm really very confident we can triple, if not quintuple, in the next 3 to 5 years.
Wow. This has been a transformative year for society. We talked a little bit about moving from self-distro to signing with a wholesaler. You mentioned your former business partner, Travis, who you guys mutually decided to end that business relationship this year. I think it was in March.
Yes.
Yeah. So you cited an increasingly divergent vision for that. What's it like essentially going through a brewery divorce?
Yeah. So just to clarify, what I said was we stopped seeing eye to eye.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really tough. I mean, we were best friends and business partners. And the way Travis says it is that daddy and daddy got a divorce and Doug got to keep the house and kids. I mean, it was tough. I mean, the guy changed my life, you know, for the positive. And he helped me start something that I couldn't do on my own. And it's probably vice versa. And going through that process, you know, I don't want to speak for Travis, but it was hard. It was very hard. It was a life will never be the same again thing, but there is some benefit out of there. And, you know, we co-parented the company and now there's only one decision maker. So going forward, it's kind of been a restructuring of sorts to where we can build this process that there are things in place where it's not like a ask Travis and Doug or ask Travis or Doug or ask Doug, then Doug goes to Travis or ask Travis, then Travis goes to Doug. It's kind of a nice feeling being that I make the decision and I've got to, you know, we fail and die or succeed based off of like my final say and not from an egotistical standpoint. Like I've done a lot of delegating. So
no pressure.
No, but I like the pressure. I like the risk. I like the pressure. But what's been great, because there is a sole decision maker, if there needs to be, is I've passed off a lot of decision making to other people. And now, you know, our tasting room manager doesn't have to come to me for approval and worry about somebody else, and our or vice versa, you know, go to Travis and then worry about me. It's I can empower our managers and leadership team to make decisions, and it frees me up. And the greatest thing I can do for this company is work on it and not for it. And I'm a firm believer in working on my company and not for my company. And that's allowed me to do that.
So how do you sort of balance, you know, being friends and running a business? I mean, we see so many of them from, you know, Carl Strauss to Russian River or to whoever it is, Stone, you know. Yeah. They start as friends, you know, and then they have to run a business together. How do you strike that balance?
First of all, you have to be very good friends. And I think it can't just be like a, oh, I like what you're doing. For me and Travis, it was easy. We saw eye to eye on everything for the longest time, and really do. We have the same philosophy on beer. It just, you know, the market changed, and we started not seeing eye to eye on things. And for people out there with business partners, y'all probably know what I'm talking about, but you pick and choose your battles and what you're going to fight, and you have to compromise and you have to be accepting. It's like a marriage. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the statistics show that 93% of business partnerships don't work, which is absolutely crazy and it's sad, but that's the fact. Maybe it's more in beer because, shit, it's beer and beer's a lot of fun. But it's tough when you have to make very hard decisions all the time. And, you know, Travis and I never had any blowout fights. We never argued with each other. It was an incredibly healthy relationship between the two of us, and I'm fortunate and grateful for that.
So when you dissolve a business relationship like that, how do you sort of go back to your employees and break the news to them and sort of maintain a culture from there?
That's been tough. You know, Travis is always and will forever be such a part of society. I mean, he's ingrained in it. It's hard to break the news to them, but we just focus on the future and try and not look in the rearview mirror at all. And I think that's a good life motto is that, look, that already happened. Let's see what we can all do together going forward. And let's work through any problem there is and let's work together on it, because there's no point of not voicing concern or frustration or anything that's going on. And I like pointing out weaknesses in people so they can get better, right? There's no point of just boxing it up and shoving it deep down inside of you. And let's see what we have in front of us. And just because things have changed doesn't mean Travis isn't a part of this or wasn't a part of this or that you guys can't be in touch with him. It's just kind of like a version 2.0. Doesn't mean it's better. Doesn't mean it's worse. It's focus on the positive, focus on the future. And that's kind of what I've really tried to drive down everybody's. We have a very bright future. Mm-hmm. And will it be different? Sure. A little bit different, but our core values are still the same. Just because Travis isn't with society anymore doesn't mean we're not going to, you know, maintain our culture.
So looking ahead to that future, 7 years in, how has your definition of success evolved in that time?
Ooh, that's tough. Okay, so when I was 25 and wanted to start this brewery, or 26, I don't know what it was, definition of success was getting guys like Garrett Oliver and Tommy Arthur to say, damn, your beer is good. And now it's very much, how can I create a company that is profitable and successful and a great place to work for everybody around me? I consider myself a socialist capitalist. I wanted to start my own brewery. And I think it's weird for people that, like, they think that they don't want to do their own thing and they want to work for somebody else. So it's my duty to make sure every day they wake up, they go, hell yeah, I get to go work in an awesome place. And when the time comes and we meet our maker, they go, I gave it my all at a place I really believe in. And I had a great life and I gave half of my life to this company. That's all I want. I want to create that. I want people to be just thrilled and pumped and passionate about society. And that's a lot of what I focus on now outside of like the logistical things is it's my duty to make this place an awesome workplace outside of an awesome company. I mean, it's Herb Kelleher from Southwest is my idol in business. And I think Southwest is one of the greatest, if not the greatest company of the modern era.
Why?
Just his outlook on business. It wasn't driven by profit. It was employees first, customers second, shareholders third. And I think that's such a great mindset.
And that's what you do.
That's what we try to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's a, you know, it's a struggle, not a struggle, but it's something we fight for every single day.
Well, yeah, as a growing business in one of the, you know, toughest markets to run a business in one of the, you know, how many breweries are there in San Diego?
165, 170 with like another 40 tap rooms, something like that.
Yeah. So not a lot of competition in San Diego for you guys.
Yeah. None.
Yeah. So.
No, I love the idea of you take care of your employees, everything else will fall into place. And I want to make more money so we can pay everybody better. Like, I would love to be above the minimum wage for our front of house staff. I would love for just to kind of like, I don't want to say envy or shame, but like, I want people to look at society and go, damn, they don't have turnover. That's a hell of a place to work, and that's very hard to get into.
Yeah.
And I would love to hire everybody and make everybody happy, but I got to take care of who we have under the roof right now, and that's my main concern.
Yeah, that's a great way to end it. Thanks, Doug. Appreciate the time.
Thank you, Justin.
Yep. Cheers.
Wow, Justin. Lots of companies go through changes where a co-founder starts to sit back or leave. But one thing that's interesting to me is that craft breweries, they're like these small artisanal factories. They're almost like sitcom settings. And that reduction of founder voices is like losing a star. So it's got to resonate loudly with what's missing. What's your sense of its effect on society as an observer?
I think it's just as Doug said, you've got one voice now, you got one direction, and you can really hone in and focus now and move the business forward without somebody going to the other owner or that sort of push-pull between ownership.
There's nothing worse than getting mommy-daddied when you're trying to get
no
things done.
No one wants to be mommy-daddied.
Trust me, as a daddy, I hate being mommy-daddied. But beyond that, is it affecting the liquid?
No, not at all.
So one thing that struck me about Douglas is that there's just a ton of craft sensibility in society. It's one of the breweries that I think of as really reflecting that entrepreneurial and artistic nature that drew so many folks into craft beer early on. Now, as the industry changes, do you see any concerns? Do you have any concerns that we'll start to lose these kinds of almost passion-based shops?
there's always going to be passion-based shops, but if you take a look at somebody like Doug, he's a studied guy. You know, he idolizes the founder of Southwest Airlines. That's not a typical answer. Like, you typically want hear somebody say, oh, Ken Grossman or Jim Cook or Sam Calagione or any of the brewery names. But you look at somebody like Doug and it's like very much a focused business. It's that kind of mindset, I think, that drives some of these companies forward. I don't worry about society in that regard. I mean, Doug is just as passionate about beer. I mean, it comes through in this interview. It comes through when you see him out, you know, working the table at GABF or any of these events. But, you know, he's very much a business-minded guy, and that's going to push society forward.
And that's what happens with so many entrepreneurial companies is that passion really has to meet execution.
Mm-hmm. Without question, this is just kind of like leveling up, you know, moving in the direction away from self-distribution to working with a wholesaler. That's leveling up. Going to, you know, packaged product, that's leveling up. So you just sort of see this rising company in a very competitive market, which is San Diego.
Yeah, it can be tough though, man, because you can have debt leveling up as well.
No, who doesn't have debt?
All right, that's our show for the week. Thanks for tuning in. We're available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, Libsyn, and SoundCloud.
If you enjoyed the show, leave us a rating and a review. And if you didn't, send us a message via podcast@brewbound.com. We'll try to adjust from there. And if you'd like to be featured on the podcast, podcast@brewbound.com is how to find us. Send us an email. I will respond when I get some time. I promise I will eventually respond.
We're keeping him pretty buried right now, though, folks. So,
yeah, you heard the ad for Brewbound Live, so it's not easy getting it all together. But for this week, thank you to our audio team. Thank you to our guest, Douglas Constantiner, and all of our listeners out there. Thanks to Jeff Kleinman for joining me in the studio and getting us back on the horse here.
Well, ride on, my friend, ride on. And catch us next week for episode 2.
Until then, and our next beer or hard seltzer. Cheers.
Cheers.